Good morning.
Hello.
Hello. As we orient ourselves in the cycles of Torah readings, the holiday calendars, the seasonal cycles, we are held in balance by what Reb Moshe has called the Jewish gyroscope. The multiple wheels spinning around axes that can tip and turn in any direction to maintain balance. And in these times, we surely need to find a way to maintain balance with all the tipping and turning of climate, political, and social events. In this week's Parsha, in Ma'amidbar, we read Parsha Balak, and we recall that just a few weeks ago in Bamidbar, the people could not even depend on the ground they stood on to be solid. 2 weeks ago in Parsha Korach, and this was a Torah reading we missed discussing because we took a break for the July 4th weekend. The ground opened and swallowed up Korah and his partners in rebellion and 250 followers. In this Torah book, in Bamidbar, and in life, there is indeed no solid ground to stand on. There is, as Pema Chodron describes in her book, comfortable with uncertainty, only shifting sand beneath our feet. She writes, "The central question for us is not how we avoid uncertainty and fear, but how we relate to discomfort. How do we practice with difficulty, with our emotions, with the unpredictable encounters of an ordinary day?" Staying present with uncertainty, she explains, is how we learn to relax in the midst of chaos, how we learn to be cool when the ground beneath us suddenly disappears. We can bring ourselves back to the spiritual path countless times every day simply by exercising our willingness to rest in the uncertainty of the present moment over and over again. In this week's reading, Parshat Balak, we read about a great example of someone who refuses to tolerate uncertainty. And since he is a king, he has the wish, the fantasy, that he can actually control the outcome of events if he can just hire the best guy for the job. He has seen the Israelites take over a nearby kingdom, a kingdom that refused to allow them to pass through, and the kingdom suffered from that. And he has the image that this horde of Israelites will lick clean his land as an ox licks up the grass of the field. Terrified of being consumed by this horde of invaders, Balak sends for the visionary, the prophet, the seer, Balaam, who has the best reputation for effective curses and blessings. He hopes to be able to pay Balaam a high enough fee to get the right curse so he can control the outcome and no longer have to be afraid of the Israelites. Balak hopes to control his fate through sorcery. And the person who he wants to hire for the job, Balaam, refuses to give Balak the reassurance of certainty. When Balak's dignitaries approach Balaam, of course it's very confusing, the names sound so familiar. So when the king's dignitaries approach the prophet to offer him a high fee for the job of cursing the Israelites, The prophet responds, "Spend the night here, and I'll reply to you as the Lord may instruct me." Now, if we take this at face value, it seems that Balaam is comfortable with uncertainty. He won't give an answer, but will wait to get a message from the Lord. In other words, he seems to recognize that he's not in control and that he can't control how these events will turn out. He can only repeat the messages that he receives from the Lord. But as you can imagine, the commentaries do not agree on this. Some say that the prophet Balaam is actually just holding out for a higher fee. He's manipulating to try to satisfy his greed to get more for the job. And indeed, we are left in the end without any certainty about Balaam's motives. Balaam also is not able to feel clear about the messages he receives from the Lord. Nor can we as readers know when to take God's words at face value, because this is the confusing turn of events. God initially gives a very clear message to Balaam the first night. God said to Balaam, "Do not go with them. You must not curse that people, for they are blessed." So Balaam did as he was told and refused to go. But the king, Balak, perhaps recognizing this as an invitation to negotiate, sent more distinguished dignitaries who offered greater rewards. And though Balaam repeats that he can only do what the Lord tells him, he nevertheless leaves an opening, inviting the dignitaries to stay another night. Perhaps, as many commentaries say, he's hoping that somehow he'll convince God to give him a different answer. You know how when your kid, your little kids keep asking their parents over and over the same question, thinking, you know, maybe they'll let me watch, you know, use the iPad now, even though they refused. Well, it kind of feels like this. Maybe I'll get another answer. It seems that he's hoping that waiting another night will bring a different answer and permission to accept the high rewards for giving the curses. And that night, God came to Balaam and said to him, "If these men have come to invite you, you may go with them. But whatever I command you, that you shall do." So when he arose in the morning, Balaam saddled his ass and departed with the dignitaries. But God was incensed at his going. So an angel of the Lord placed himself in Balaam's way as an adversary. Now, this is very confusing. How are we to understand this? God says, "Okay, go ahead," and then is incensed when Balaam does go anyway. Does go. I mean, it seems as if he's just accepting at face value God's permission. So Aviva Zornberg quotes a Talmudic commentary by Rava, who is a sage from the 3rd century, which is a pretty psychological interpretation. "This teaches us," he says, "that in the way a person wants to go, he is allowed to go." In other words, Balaam really wants God to give him permission, and so God, perhaps in exasperation that Balaam came back to ask him to change his mind, God allows Balaam to go in the direction he desires. However, he makes it clear that Balaam still has to do only as God commands. But it's as if God was really intended that Balaam was really intending that Balaam should listen to God's original intention, which was that the people should be blessed. So I thought this was an interesting message. It's as if this commentator is saying, God cannot save us from our own desires and impulses. Only we can do that. However, God does intervene to change the outcome of the prophet's actions by sending the angel with the sword to block the path, and then miraculously by speaking through the mouth of Balaam's donkey, and ultimately giving Balaam the words to speak a blessing for the Israelites. So let's go back to the sage's interests in intention. When he arose in the morning, Balaam the prophet saddled his ass and departed with the dignitaries. He's setting out to do one thing and ends up doing the opposite. There's a haunting resonance with an earlier image of Abraham starting his journey up to Mount Moriah. In Genesis, we read, God put Abraham to the test, saying to him, Abraham, take your son, your favorite one, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the heights that I will point out to you. Again, follow this command, but you have to stay tuned for what I'm going to tell you. I will point out to you. So early the next morning, Abraham saddled his ass and took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. In both cases, with Balaam and Abraham, a human is trying to understand a message from God. Abraham is generally seen rather favorably by the sages as having the good intention of doing whatever God commands, even though the act itself is horrific and evil. Nevertheless, he is seen as being motivated by devotion. God intervenes and at the last moment provides a ram to sacrifice instead. In contrast, Balaam's motive is generally seen as self-serving, greed for fame and fortune. He wants God to change God's mind, and so asks him a second time, hoping to get a different answer, which he does get. And yet, in the end, despite himself, he gives a blessing. How do we understand that? Has he opened himself to God's intention, or was he simply forced by God to do the right thing? The story raises these questions about intention and action and the complexity of human motivation and devotion and about good and evil. And I would say that in the end, these stories leave us with the same bewilderment we feel when we read Zen stories, that we have no idea what they mean. And their purpose is to really help us get out of the rut of how we normally think about things too simplistically as good and evil, really help us to just recognize the complexity of everyday life. And there's another strange resonance between the two prophets, Balaam and Moses. There is the obvious comparison. Moses, as a seer, sees the burning bush and is able to pay attention and hear God's message, while Balaam, the seer, does not see the angel with the sword that's right in front of him, a vision that's perfectly visible to his donkey. But there is also an odd similarity that Aviva Zornberg points out, that they both hit or strike in frustration. Only a few chapters earlier, Moses struck the rock in frustration, and God saw this as Moses' lack of faith in God. A lifetime earlier, Moses had struck and killed an Egyptian. And in between those two episodes of striking, he struck the rock when he was commanded by God to strike the rock. Balaam strikes his ass three times in his impatience to get to his destination, in an action that demonstrates that he's not paying attention to God's messages. God promised to tell him, God promised, or God commanded that he listen and do whatever God commanded. And clearly, Balaam is so driven by his agenda that he's not able to see what his donkey can see. He can only see the angel that God has sent when his donkey begins, when his donkey speaks up. With all these odd similarities and differences, we are again left with no clear messages about who is good and who has evil intention. But there is a consistent message that is important, and that consistent message is, it's important to stay tuned for whatever is about to be revealed in the unfolding of each moment. Abraham, Moses, and Balaam all set out at some point to follow their agenda, but they can do God's will only by staying attuned to every new signal that arises. Abraham at Mount Moriah needs to lift his eyes and see the ram. Moses needs to listen more closely and not act on impulse. Balaam needs to open his eyes to see what's in front of him. So again, in each of these stories, whether we see this as tuning in to pick up on God's attention or tuning in to do what is most skillful in response to what evolves in each moment, the message is you have to keep paying attention to a reality that is constantly changing. So, one drawback of these stories, I think, is that the image, the message, in all of these stories comes as a rather extraordinary image, an extraordinary vision, an extraordinary message. An angel with a sword, a talking donkey, a burning bush. I don't know about you, but I've never had anything so extraordinary arise to guide me. So I will end with a quote from Sojourner Mel Waitzman, who was the Zen teacher of Norman and Kathy Fisher, and his teachings were published posthumously in a book called, this book was called Follow One Thing Through. And I'm reading from a little chapter called Nothing Special. And he wrote, "Today I was looking through a book for a spark to set off this talk and ran across an old question from a student who asked, 'The phrase nothing special keeps coming up for me. Could you please talk about its meaning?' It is a good question, which is at the heart of our practice. Suzuki Roshi used this phrase a lot. Back in the 60s, when young people were looking for profound experiences in psychedelics, some were investigating meditation. D.T. Suzuki, a different teacher, was popularizing a style of Rinzai, a side of Rinzai style that emphasized koan training, leading to kensho, or sudden awakening. In contrast, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi's training in the Soto school led him to understand that what brings us to practice is our inherently enlightened mind. Suzuki Roshi did not encourage attainment. He said that when we are always looking over there for something, it's harder to appreciate where we are right now. With this understanding, grasses, pebbles, and streams are always preaching the Dharma and teaching us how to act. So there is nothing special to achieve. And yet everything is special in its own unique form and way and should be fully respected and appreciated as a form of Buddha nature. Recently, we were studying the Buddhist precepts of different schools. Some have 250 precepts, some have 16, some have none. Suzuki Roshi respected them, but his understanding was that precepts are simply our way of navigating our life. When we pay attention to our surroundings and keep our senses and mind unassuming and open, everything we encounter brings us back to our compassionate, joyful, and harmonious practice. It is not that we ignore enlightening moments, but even when they are extraordinary, they are at the same time not more extraordinary than the ordinary sight of the divine light of a periwinkle by the side of the road.